I'm David S. Reynolds, and I'm a distinguished professor at the CUNY Graduate Center in English and American Studies, and I graduated from Amherst in 1970. Debbie, I want to first of all congratulate you on this fabulous book, The Most Famous Man in America, the biography of Henry Ward Beecher, Beecher being the influential 19th century preacher and reformer, social reformer, who was from an amazing family. And the reception of your book has been great. My own blurb.
That's right.
When I was nicely sent the proofs I wrote at that time, and I still believe it, Debbie Applegate brings to life 19th century America's most influential preacher, who emerges in this full-blooded portrait as a fascinating tangle of all-too-human traits. Drawing off an impressive body of research, the author expertly weaves together biography and history in a riveting narrative that reads like a page-turning novel. So, and then you got a number of other great blurbs.
And when that blurb came in from you, I must say, I did a little dance, I think, in my office. So I don't think I said thank you appropriately.
Well, let me ask, how did you first encounter me? And how
I said I wanted to talk about that because I encountered you and Beecher about the same time. I had a job. I have told this story in Amherst forums before, but I love it, so I'm going to tell it again. I had a little work-study job in the Amherst College Archives, and I was given an assignment. One of my very first assignments was to do a little exhibit in the front cases of Frost Library on notorious alumni, and Beecher was the first, and I immediately thought, he's great. And of course, I loved it in particular because I was living in South just the year before, and I could look out at him and think, who is that portly man in a cape? and so this was my moment to discover, not just religion, not just politics, but sex too. And so I had a class with a fantastic professor, my advisor, Bob Gross. And the first thing he said was, you must know David Reynolds' little essay about narrative and sermons, which maybe doesn't sound enthralling to everyone, but I could not believe you had written a subject just on that.
My first publication, yeah.
Yeah, was it your very first publication?
Actually, it was my second. My previous one had included Beecher. It was about religion in the Gilded Age. That was in the Journal of Popular Culture, but then this one came out in American Quarterly, yeah.
And it was huge. I mean, it taught me about analysis. It taught me how to look at genre as historical evidence. It taught me how to sort of move back and forth between form and content. And so then after that, and of course, you knew who Beecher was, so that was all the more exciting. So as I went along, it became the topic of my senior thesis. And then I went to graduate school at Yale in the American Studies Department. And it became the topic of my dissertation. Meanwhile, while I am chugging along with little Beecher, you are churning out fantastic book after fantastic book, including your first, which I used heavily. And then I was in graduate school. I remember it vividly. I was studying for my oral exams, and your book Underneath the American Renaissance.
Beneath the
American Renaissance. And I remember I bought it, which I never buy new books. I bought it. And I remember sitting on a bus and opening it up and just feeling this wave of pleasure go through me, because this was the book I wanted to write. And if I couldn't write it, then it was the book I really wanted to read. So it confirmed my fandom. And then, of course, I relied also quite a bit on your John Brown biography. So it's a genuine honor. And please don't ask hard questions.
Oh, no, never, never. No, not I. It's very easy to interview someone as talented as you.
Thank you.
And also someone who happens to be very much on my own wavelength. I was going to ask you the phrase of the most famous American, most famous man in America. I guess it was Lincoln who called him the most influential, or one of the most influential men, or who was it who used a phrase similar to that?
Many people did. Yeah, I mean, it was sort of common wisdom, almost, you know, that kind of conventional wisdom that almost sounds silly. And When it comes down to the question of influence, of course, that is an endless topic of debate. We could spend years talking about who was the most influential American. But I think it is not an exaggeration to say that Henry was the most famous. Lincoln, okay, we can give Lincoln his due, but Lincoln died 5 years after being almost a nobody. Mm-hmm. So he became a myth. Right. Emerson, I would say, gives him a good run for his money. But, you know, how many people actually read Emerson? Today, you might say. Mm-hmm. We all know who he is. But, you know, at the time, Beecher was that man who combined high and low, entertainment and seriousness, religion and a spiciness. He really covered it all. So in some ways, when people ask me, well, who said the most famous man in America? Well, actually, I guess I said it. Mm-hmm. I should say, however, that Lincoln did say there was a moment of, even I love Beecher in all his foibles, but even I thought it was too much when Lincoln said, well, we are going to have him come down and raise the flag over Fort Sumter, because without Beecher, there would have been no flag to raise. Right. And even I thought, well, that, frankly, sounds like a little too much, maybe a little political posturing. But then, not long after that, I ran across no less than Robert E. Lee himself being quoted in a very respectable source saying the same thing. So I don't argue anymore.
Can you describe to us the process of writing your dissertation or your thesis at Yale, and then going from that and actually seeing this book into publication? What were the steps that were taken there? How long did it take? And did you approach a publisher, or did a publisher approach you? And all of that.
A biblical amount of time. It took 7 years to do my PhD. I had 3 years on Beecher before, and then 7 years after I signed the book contract to publish it. And really, in some ways, it was despair that turned it into a commercial book, a trade book. It turned out, when I graduated from graduate school in, I guess it was 98, I finished in 97, and taught for a year at Yale. And what I discovered when I was going to go on the job market was that, quite frankly, a dead white congregational minister was a lot less valuable in the academic marketplace than he was on the open marketplace, the commercial marketplace. Mm-hmm. And it was actually easier for me to sell a trade book, to find an agent, and to sell a trade book than it was for me to get a job in a place that I wanted to teach. I think the problem was all I wanted to do was go back to Amherst or a place like Amherst.
Sure.
No, and Amherst did not call and offer me a job right away.
Yeah.
And not yet either. I'm still waiting.
Still waiting. Well, maybe after this interview.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows?
Pitching.
Yeah, it's I'm in the academic job market too, so I know the competitiveness. In our field, quite often, you can send out 25 letters if you just got your PhD, and half of them won't even be answered, or maybe with a little postcard, I'm sorry, you're not.
Well, you know. And it's also true that I'm a native Westerner. I'm from Oregon, and came back east only to go to college, and I am really, much as I love the West, though, a born-again Yankee. And part of it was I didn't want to leave this place that I love so much.
You mentioned Bob Gross. What other aspects of the Amherst experience sort of lies at the source of your book? That is to say, what kind of inspirations? Obviously, the exhibit that you put on there in the Frost Library and the seminar and so forth. But was there something about the Amherst atmosphere or other professors or certain values of humanistic pursuit or something about Amherst that you feel influenced you?
Oh, everything about Amherst. I am a big booster, as anyone will tell you. And I have to say, part of it was that contrast between the West and a place like Amherst, where everything is new out West. Everything was built, you know, 25 years ago. And what I wanted was that sense of continuity and history. And I had never even seen the campus when I arrived, and it was exactly what I wanted. I lived in South Dorm. Henry lived in North, well, it was actually Middle Dorm, but he lived in North Dorm.
Yeah.
And you know, it looked like it was there. To have a job in the archives where I could just touch all of these old books, all this old stuff. I mean, that was part of it. Part of it was that combination of atmosphere and intellectualism. Part of it is, this I often find is controversial, but I am myself a bookworm, through and through, always was. And Amherst was the first place I had ever been that was full of bookworms.
Right,
In fact, I serve on the Council of the Friends of the Frost Library now, and one of the things I often say to people is I think from knowing so many Amherst people of so many ages and knowing so many other kinds of graduates, are there other kinds, that really what distinguishes Amherst is bookishness. I think most people would in their heart of hearts say that. And as someone who has written about, who has frankly been writing about Amherst and Beecher for so long, long enough that many of my old friends thought that it had just become some strange obsession and I was never going to publish. Is there really a book? I think I am the repository now of a lot of Amherst alums who will come up to me at talks and say, oh, I have a book that I've been meaning to write, or I wish I had written a book, or there is nothing I love more than authors. And I think that I never had been in a place like that, and that is huge.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was in a similar kind of situation because in my class we had Scott Turow and David Eisenhower and... So Scott Turow and I, we'll see each other in a few.
What class are you? I've forgotten.
1970. So we'll kind of sit and chat at our alumni, gatherings. Other than that, and sometimes we're in contact. If I see him on C-SPAN or something, drop him an email. But he, you're absolutely right. I mean, the kind of bookish atmosphere at Amherst was just fantastic.
And I should say the thesis atmosphere that it is a very unusual thing, at least it was when I was there, that people took their senior theses very seriously.
Yeah.
There was a real culture of what I'm going to do is culminate my career here at Amherst in a piece of writing. And, that was huge. That was psychologically the biggest thing because I could prove, as an American studies major, one kind of always worries that they're a dilettante. It was my opportunity to prove something to myself and to the rest of the world that I think changed my confidence forever. Yeah.
That's the first time I thought I really got serious when I was writing my senior thesis. And I remember sitting, I forgot what dorm I was in, but I was the only one there during spring vacation. And we had a late snow, so I was actually very late. It was in March, I think. And so I was surrounded by snowdrifts and writing my... But it was fun.
Yeah.
And it was about John Donne's songs and sonnets, and something that I've not revisited since then. But still, as you say, it's an incredibly growing experience.
Well, I noticed that even when I talk to lawyers or doctors, or I just interviewed Dr. Drew Pinsky for the Amherst Alumni Magazine, maybe not familiar to every Amherst person, but hugely famous advice giver, medical advice giver, radio show, TV shows.
Right.
He's now got a big series called Celebrity Rehab.
And
when I went to talk to him, it was the exact same thing. He said he loved everything, and it was the bookishness. It was his favorite professor was Hadley Arkes.
To this day,
he says Hadley Arkes is still the main influence on his reading.
Yeah. When I went to Amherst, the first course we took, I don't know if they still have it, it was simply called, it was freshman writing, and I think it was just called writing. And the professor, his remark on my first paper was, all of this is inflated. Some of it is downright silly. That's all. And there was no grade. There was no grade. That it punctured my balloon.
Yeah.
My balloon so horribly.
Oh, yes.
But it was very good for me.
I got a C, my very first paper, and in New England, the class was New England.
I got a C.
Oh, for God's sakes, boy, did that put the fear of God in me.
That kind of thing is very healthy in the long run. Let's get back to Beecher. What do you have a sense of what his Amherst years were like? Not that you can necessarily totally recreate them, but the people that he knew and how it might have influenced him in any way.
Oh, Amherst was everything to him. He was a a blithe, boisterous boy who really, frankly, didn't care much for school, didn't really like authority figures very much, had no real use for religion, but he was the son of one of the most famous ministers in America, Lyman Beecher, the great Lyman Beecher. And so his father had actually originally wanted him to go to Yale, but his own alma mater. But he thought the classes were too big, and they were taught by tutors, and there were and there was not enough writing, and so he would probably get lost. Which is, I find funny because it's the exact same story nowadays. No offense against Yale. So when Henry got to Amherst, for one thing, it was very intensely religious. It was very ambitious. As Emerson said, they're like young Hercules, studying and writing with a passion. And in fact, there were classmates of his who were actually named for his father, like Lyman Beecher Harkin. I mean, imagine arriving at Amherst and knowing that you were going to be on the spot. And and it was very hard for him. He had that kind of miserable first freshman semester. But very quickly, he found all those things that I think kids nowadays find. He enjoyed debating, just sitting. His favorite thing was just sitting around shooting bullshit in the dorms, talking, debating, being part of the clubs. He got more out of class than perhaps his grades showed. He discovered romanticism. European romanticism was a hot new topic then. He discovered science. Science was the hot new topic then. He was there when the first scientific equipment arrived.
Was he there with one of the Fowler brothers? Like
that's
Lorenz?
Right. Yeah, that's right. Phrenology.
Phrenology,
The measurement of bumps on your head.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I wanted to ask you something else. When he, you know, what did he do after Amherst? How did he get from there to becoming, if not the most famous preacher in the 1850s, certainly one of the most famous? What was the thing, you know, how do you get to Beecher's Church from Manhattan? What, take the ferry and follow the crowd or
that's
something
right,
like
that's
that?
That's right, that's what
yeah.
he was.
Anyway.
He became New York's number one tourist attraction in his heyday. And he was not a great, I mean, you're absolutely, it's a great question because, as he liked to say, when he graduated from Amherst, the only time he was near the head of the class was when they were standing all in a circle. he was one of the few students who did not speak at graduation. But what he had going for him was he was heading out to the exotic western state of Ohio with his father, who was starting a seminary out there. And the Beecher family as a whole is a huge influential clan, and they were going to come out and bring Yankee wisdom and good values out to the Wild West, and so
and to save it from Catholicism,
save it from heathenism in general, you name it. And he didn't like Episcopalians or Unitarians either, Lyman. So I mean, they lumped them together with thieves and drunkards. So I think it was really going west, and he had that Eastern education. He had he was an establishment figure, but then he got, as they say, Methodized. He met the less educated, the often illiterate people who didn't want the parsing, they didn't want the philosophy, they didn't want the highfalutin words. They wanted emotion, they wanted drama, they wanted something that would touch their souls.
He probably also, as his sister Harriet Beecher Stowe, was exposed to the horrors of slavery a little bit because it's close to the Ohio River and all of that. And the whole controversy at Lane Seminary over abolitionism. So can you tell us about that a little bit, how perhaps Henry became, quote, abolitionized a little bit?
That's
I know
right.
he never became an abolitionist of the Garrison type, but still, he was quite forceful in his own denunciations of slavery.
Well, and that's what makes him an interesting figure, I think. Yeah. As a Beecher, he had very conservative impulses deep down. His training was somewhat conservative, Eastern establishment. But his passion, all the passion that he had learned as an advocate, really, and the liberalism that was actually more part of his personality. You know, if we could split one's personality, personality versus your genetic and family heritage, his personality was liberal in the best sense, open-hearted, open-minded, curious, tolerant, just a charming, humorous, a good sense of human nature as not being one thing or another, but a mixed bag that we all have to tolerate and love. And that mixed with the politics of the day made him half the time a dramatic advocate for the slave and half the time somebody who wanted to shrink away from mm-hmm. the political and economic implications. It would be a revolution, of course, to get rid of slavery.
Yeah, he wasn't very happy about Harper's Ferry and John Brown and so forth.
That's
like
right.
That. He kind of,
well, he was half
yeah.
and half.
Yeah.
He could never decide. Yeah. And that's what made him, that's why he never, you know, that's why people remember Harriet, his sister, Harriet
right.
Beecher Stowe, and not him, because ultimately, he wrote plenty of books, plenty of essays, sermons. He even wrote a novel, an autobiographical novel
Norwood,
with a good
yeah.
chunk of it that takes place in Amherst. It's clearly him until he gets to the war eras, and then he becomes a general, which he did not. You can tell, though, he frankly is just not that great a writer. I mean, that's not his gift. As,
right.
as he said, that novel finally laid to rest the longstanding rumor that it was he, not Harriet, who had written Uncle Tom's Cabin. he was a speaker. That, I mean,
right,
that's the
right.
difference. That's when his feelings would come out and overrule his conservative instincts. So he would whip people up with his imitations, with his thunderous stories, with his ability to dramatize the mm-hmm. terrors of slavery in a way that then when he was quiet and in his study and actually writing things down for posterity, he didn't want to go as far.
Right, right. Do you think there was a certain difficulty involved in being in a family of such strong egos and strong presences? I mean, after all, there was Catherine Beecher, there was Harry Beecher Stowe, but also...
call the Martha Stewart and the Dan Brown of their day.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And actually, Henry, my editor hates it, you might call him the Forrest Gump of his day, which I
right.
guess explains your point.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, most of those Beecher kids, siblings, were, and the father, of course, they were just famous, just very famous in their own right. Or do you think they kind of fed off each other?
I think very much. I mean,
yeah.
I have been very lucky with readers and criticism. I have not gotten a lot of criticism, but the one criticism that I do sometimes get that really bothers me, sticks in my craw, is that I somehow am anti-Calvinist because I so often quote the children and their
yep.
problems with their childhood rear,
right.
their upbringing in this ambitious, serious Calvinist household, and that I am perhaps not fair to Henry's father, Lyman. But I feel the reason I find that so unfair is I have nothing but respect for Calvinism and for mm-hmm. Lyman Beecher, that even as one of the great traditionalists, the grand defender, the last great Puritan minister in America, he treated his children like they were special, like even the girls had something to contribute, that they could make a difference simply by being their best selves and
mm-hmm.
being
mm-hmm.
ambitious. And it's hard not to find that charming. And especially when compared to Henry's later lapses.
Well, there's also the opposite criticism that you probably haven't been subjected to, but I suppose you could if you're at all a Henry Ward Beecher advocate, is that the neo-Orthodox and neo-Calvinists of the 20th century sometimes looked back on the kind of religion that Beecher represented, Henry Ward Beecher, and called it kind of the religion of gush.
Right, that's right.
This kind
right.
of liberal Protestantism that was simplistic and too optimistic. So I suppose in treating his religious things, you did have to ride a fine line between admiring his ability to communicate and all that, but at the same time recognize that theologically perhaps there wasn't too much of interest, so to speak, in his own.
You know, a number of things. One thing is, I think the reason I was attracted to Beecher at the very beginning,
yeah.
as a sophomore in college, was that I was from one of those rapidly suburbanizing rural areas that are prime evangelical breeding grounds. So there was
yeah.
a lot of evangelical churches, a lot of people I knew in high school. And I am from a family that is half Irish Catholic and half Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a strong sense of religion as being a very authoritarian thing,
yeah.
As not being a particularly intellectual or open-minded thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things was I I think I found this sort of liberalism, this reaching across denominational lines to do good, if not to be good, seductive and appealing. I found Henry lovable. Yeah. But there is no question that I shouldn't tell the story of it. There was a point at which anytime you're writing biography, it's a whole Oedipal mess. It's always an Oedipal mess, and all the more when there's 12 kids, each of whom wants to be the top dog. At one point, when I was in the middle of writing and I felt like it wasn't going very well, I thought, well, I'm going to go back and see my old shrink, my old therapist who I'd seen in graduate school. And I said, okay, now we're only going to come maybe 6 sessions. I'm only going to talk about the book. We're not going to talk about my mother or my family or anything, which, of course, turned out to not be true anyway, of course, because writing is all Oedipal. Turns out everything is. And he says, finally, he says after the first session, well, who do you relate to here? As if he knew the answer. And, of course, it must be Henry, right? Yeah. And I said, well, oh, it's Lyman, of course. I mean, Lyman's the only decent man among them. And my therapist, cracks up that I think is inappropriate for a therapist. And, of course, it made me think, oh, right, that so often writing, you choose your subjects because you relate to something about them. And then by the time you really get to know them, of course, there's lots that you don't like.
That's really interesting, I felt the same way about John Brown.
Did you? Well, of course.
Absolutely. How did you, now his marriage with Eunice, do you feel that was, eventually he commits adultery and all of that. Do you think there was something intrinsically wrong with that marriage from the beginning in your view, or is it hard to go back and psychoanalyze or be a marriage counselor for...
Well, you have to. I mean, I think a little bit. It's part of the business of being a biographer is being a lay psychologist, a lay philosopher, a lay historian. You have to combine them all. I guess, people often ask biographers in particular what you learned from writing this. And I often say I have 3 lessons, and they all pertain to Eunice. The first lesson is... Do not marry the first girl you meet in college, brother, your roommate's sister, the first girl who pays any attention to you. I mean, that's really what happened. Yeah. He was walking home from freshman year. He walked from Amherst to Boston with 2 of his friends, and he stayed overnight at the farmhouse. By the next morning, he was in love because he was girl crazy, and she paid attention to him, and he was a beecher. And pretty much it never went bad. He had a long engagement, and by the time they married, they really didn't have the personalities. He was affable, easygoing, optimistic. She was a little on the hypochondriacal, insecure, negative side. So one thing is that. But the second thing is, if you're going to marry the first girl who pays any attention to you, if you're going to marry your first roommate's sister, then do not cheat on her. And this really makes all the difference in the world. And the third lesson is, and I say this advisedly because I wouldn't have been able to write the book without this, but if you're going to marry that girl and if you're going to cheat on her, do not write things down. That's a critical part.
3 good lessons.
That's right.
How did you find out some of the, let's say, juicier details about certain of his affairs? Well, can you tell us about his affairs?
Well, and I should say from the outset that there is question about these affairs. I was not in the room, and nobody actually was. There is not absolute firsthand, unimpeachable testimony. So it is a mystery. And in fact, a big part of the book was trying not just to find an answer, a definitive answer, but trying to write a book that would have the suspense of that question inherent in it, so that the person who's reading the book could feel like a jury, member of that jury, trying to judge whether or not he was innocent. On the other hand, the way you, as you know, as a historian, the way you put together a case like that, and I didn't prejudge it, is a combination of things. One is I just searched for every little scrap right. of documentation that I could find.
Was it mainly in a place like New York Public Library? Or what archives did you use?
The trouble with the Beechers is there's so many of them. They're all novelists, essay writers, and blabbermouths, and letter writers. So there's tons of material, and it's well collected. And now, in this day and age, if I were writing it now, I almost would have too much information because there are so many databases that you can call up things that I never would have seen.
Yeah.
So one thing was just that, just the immersion in the material and looking for clues. Some of it was very specific, but some of it was psychological in that, for example, he was clearly girl crazy from the time that he was 7 years old. His mother died when he was three. He was raised by all these That's right. Well, he had a very distant but beautiful stepmother who he longed for approval but never got. He had all these bevy of ambitious, interesting sisters who doted on him but didn't have real time for him. I think, and he fantasized about his mother as that unconditional love that he never quite had. So it's not, he was a classic setup. I mean, of all of the things that go on, I even read Pastoral Man. I read, everything I could on adultery, on these kinds of circumstances. I read pastoral manuals on adulterous pastors, and he fit every little pattern there. He didn't have strong institutional ties. He had a little cult of personality. He didn't have a lot of friends who were ministers.
Right.
So part of it is circumstantial. And then part of it is searching the archives. And then part of it is just good luck. He was accused at the height of his career in 1870 of seducing Elizabeth Tilton, the wife of one of his best friends, or former best friends, and one of his most pious parishioners. And I kept thinking, okay, that was the one that nobody could ever decide. It ends, the civil trial ends in a hung jury, 9 in favor of his innocence, 3 of his guilt. It's very hard to say. I think nowadays we would probably have gone the other way, but it might still be a hung jury. But I could never find that smoking gun. I wanted something definitive. But then, while searching for that, another smoking gun landed in my lap. A long letter, a private collector had bought it. She writes about Harriet, of course. Everyone remembers Harriet. And she pulls it out. It has no signature, no return address, but it's to Henry. And it's in very distinctive handwriting. It's very long and very detailed. Mm-hmm. And it is very sad. Written by one of his close friends and neighbors in Brooklyn, describing how they had first met Henry. They had to move to Brooklyn to become members of the church. Mm-hmm. And the last 10 years of slowly watching his wife fall more and more and more in love with Henry. Mm-hmm. Until this night, he rises from his sleepless bed to write this letter to beg him to release him from his grief and pain.
Right.
Now, this has nothing to do with Elizabeth Tilton. This is a different best friend, a different neighbor, a different parishioner, a different cuckold, if you will. And all of a sudden, that led me on a whole separate goose chase that really did become much more solid. And in the end, if there is something that is a contribution here, it's a little bit of a sordid one, but I think I might have found a possible, they used to call them love childs, love children, love child, illegitimate child. And again, I can't say for sure. We don't have any DNA evidence to really prove it. But I will say this. I have pictures of her, and you just do not get jowls like that at the age of 15 without some genetic intervention.
And was this alleged love child with a former alleged mistress?
Had ever talked about her before. She was entirely a
Because I remember one affair that you believe he had, perhaps in the 1850s, right?
With a poet, Edna Dean Proctor.
With the poet, And how did you find out the details of that?
Well, one of the things, as I know you know, is history is not as far away as it seems. A lot of these things that would pop up, I couldn't necessarily use. I mean, some of them I could use and some of them I couldn't. A lot of it, however, was in the legal documents, and nobody had ever just paid attention to these other things. Everyone was for one thing, Henry's been forgotten, frankly, so no one had given it sustained attention. But with this poet, I think was probably his first big misstep, if indeed it happened. And it was clear that he sort of pushed himself on her enough that she says at some, she's quoted as saying, "I was raped." On the other hand, if it was rape, it was date rape, and she continued, it seems like, to have had an affair with him. His response to that accusation, according to the legal documents, appalled me. This was around the time I started to go see my shrink. he's accused, "Well, you raped this woman, you raped," and she was a poet, a governess, "you pretty much raped a virgin," is how it was said. Yeah. And he said, "Well, I know she wasn't a virgin. I know she'd been with other," and I thought, well, that's the frat boy excuse. I mean, and so I had thought that this, I had put the pieces together. I knew who it probably was. I knew when it probably happened. Mm-hmm. I thought the evidence was good. And then just before the book went to press, I got a call from an archivist at a historic house in eastern Connecticut, the place called Roseland, a really beautiful old mansion that's open to the public, where Henry spent many years. And she calls and says, "I have to come down to New Haven. I have to read this to you." She reads, they had just discovered this document in a roll-top desk, and it was a confession written by a female doctor who had interviewed the maid who had seen this encounter. And it's very high purple Victorian prose, how the maid lets Henry in. Edna will not see him, but finally she says, "This is your pastor, how can you not?" They go into the parlor door, click the lock. The maid stands outside listening, like a little upstairs, downstairs story. Yeah. As soon as Henry leaves, she goes in and finds Edna crying there. And she says, "What's happened?" And she says, "I have been raped." Now, it's third hand, so it was going to be a pain in the neck to try to work it in. Yeah. It was also just before I went to press, so I had no desire to rewrite it. But of course, this is a hot, hot thing. It's all the details. It says where. It says when. It allows me to tell the story.
Sure.
And the archivist says, "But you can't use it." Uh-oh. And I was like, "You drove down here for all this?" She says, "Well, you know, the family members might get mad." And I thought, really? And
oh, boy, that's funny. Yeah. So it didn't. That particular letter didn't end up in
well,
the book.
Well, it fit the details I already had, I basically just didn't say where it was. And this is my time to say Roseland Cottage, sorry.
Who was Victoria Woodhull, and what role does she play in this whole Henry Ward Beecher scandal?
Well, you know, like Henry, one of the great American characters. It is a book full of all the best American, well, maybe not the best, but the most fun and colorful American characters. She was a woman now remembered as the first woman to run for the U.S. presidency. First woman to have a seat on the stock exchange. She had her own newspaper. She was also a clairvoyant who could talk to the dead, and an advocate for what they used to call free love. I think we call it American culture nowadays. And she gets hold of the rumors of the scandal. She hears about it. She is under attack for her free love advice, especially by Henry's respectable sisters. It just goes to show history is pretty personal, even as it is also pretty impersonal. She decides she's going to let loose this secret to the press. And that's really what sets off this huge scandal. I mean, this scandal, it's hard to even appreciate it now. It makes the O.J. Simpson trial or the Michael Jackson trial look like small potatoes. It is had more headlines than the entire Civil War, actually.
Wow, yeah. And how long did the actual trial last? How many years?
Well, this trial lasted about 6 months. The scandal, maybe a year and a half, two years altogether. In the end, people were very divided. What really Henry was someone who people could relate to in a way that was very new. He was not a stiff minister. He was not a patrician politician. He was not even a writer. He was a character, a personality who had been so warm and so loving, that gospel of love, that one who said, "Oh, no, God is not about fire and brimstone. God is about loving you." That was so important to so many people that I think most people just couldn't wouldn't believe it. And mm-hmm. and many letters said, I don't care if he is guilty. I mm-hmm. will not believe it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he emerges from this trial with his reputation perhaps slightly tarnished, but still immensely popular, would you say?
Oh,
nonetheless,
yeah. You know, this is America, and Americans are very forgiving people as long as they don't think you're a hypocrite. And Americans also like to decide things for themselves. And so, in fact, he only lived about 10 years after the trial. Finally, the scandal finally dies down. He makes more money in those last 10 years of his life than any other time. He does a series of national lecture tours. And what happens is all these people, whether they hate him or whether they love him, turn out because they want to decide for themselves. Is he innocent or is he the great libertine? I mean, so many people turn out that, you know, sidewalks are crushed, that they have to evacuate places because there's too many people. Even in the South, where he is a pariah, people come out. And the only real sad part, once again, for poor Eunice, who never got the good end of the stick. He makes tons of money. He puts it all into a beautiful summer home on the Hudson and does not save a dime. And so when he dies in 1887, there's a $25,000 insurance policy, and everything else has to be sold, and she has to go live with her children. She never worked for her.
how many children did they have?
Another great thing you can see about it. One of the things that's fun about biography, as you know, is you can really, it gives you a lens into so many larger historical things that are hard to understand. I think 10 children, Eunice gave birth to 10 children, two sets of twins, only four of whom lived to adulthood. And I think that goes to show that
Brown had 20 children and only eight survived him. He died at age 59, so only eight survived.
20? Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah. He wasn't spreading it around either.
Well, the average American family back then had, you know, as you know, between 7 and 9 kids, and then it declined to just over 5 at the turn of the century.
And if you're an Old Testament prophet,
John Brown.
And in fact, and the reason I always emphasize that is because, Lyman Beecher, in his child-rearing tactics, you know, he was a Calvinist who believed babies went to hell if they died because they had not had a saving experience of grace. Now, he came a little bit to modify that, but that's really what he preached when they were. And Henry remembers one of the very first thing his father, he can remember his father saying, like around age of 2 or 3, Henry, do you know every breath you breathe is a sin? Well, it is every breath. And so much of Henry's life was wanting to please his father while getting out from under that terrible Calvinist vision, terrible to him. I guess this is why I end up sounding anti-Calvinist. I think knowing that your children could be swept away and believing that they might go to hell makes Lyman's dogma seem more humane. It makes it seem more like something we can understand.
How about the transition in your writing between delivering this as an academic package for Yale and then trying to translate this into sort of a trade book? Was that a difficult transition for you, or was that one that was very exciting for you? Because your narrative, as you read it now, is very lively, and as I mentioned, it's almost like a novel. Can you describe that whole process?
Oh, it was both difficult and exciting. In fact, when I sold the book, I had very good luck even though I was so young and a first-time author, because it was during the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. And it was right in the middle, and it was a very short deadline, too, which
turned out to be totally foolish.
I don't mean to call it a mafia, but there is something about going to these good schools filled with ambitious people that I just started asking around and found somebody, a brand-new, serious editor, very serious editor, who had 20-year editor in nonfiction who was just beginning an agency. So I lucked out also there. But again, word of mouth, I always say, know interesting people because they know interesting people.
Absolutely.
But really, I remember when I sold the book, I told my mother, and my mother had been kind enough to actually read my dissertation, which was very academic. And it really was not about the scandal, much as I had wished it were. It was really about the rise of the middle class and consumer culture and mass media. And
the things that really interested you, right?
Right. Oh,
they might not interest the
very
public.
Very interesting. Yeah. Right, exactly. Oh, and I mean, the stuff I thought I knew a bunch about Beecher, none of the stuff that I had in my dissertation made it. The mental work, but not the actual. None of the words. In fact, my mother, she says, "So you sold your dissertation to a big publisher, a commercial publisher?" I said, "Yes." Yeah. I said, "But Mom, don't worry. It's going to be very different." And she actually said, "Phew!" Because I read that and it was very nice, honey. Yeah, but I'm not sure that everyone would. Yeah. And so I put myself on a moratorium. Actually, I didn't read any contemporary academic writing because it's not very lively. It's a bad influence. I found, all of a sudden, the things I needed to know were entirely different. Like, maybe before I had needed to know about the great demographic shifts that gave rise to a middle class that only thinks of itself as not middle class. But really, now what I needed to know was, how long did it take to get from Boston to Hartford by stagecoach? I mean, things that I just never thought I would need to know.
The human angle,
The human angle that tells the larger story.
Right.
Because it makes a big difference how long it takes to get by stagecoach. And so that was big. But then I found I still didn't know how to write, which was embarrassing. And actually,
even after Amherst, after Yale, or should we say especially? No, I didn't.
Yes, no. A graduate school is a fantastic thing. Yale was a wonderful place. Anyone should do it if they can. They should not take out loans if they can. But it is not the way to learn how to write, I would say. It's the way to learn how to think. And so, actually, this is, embarrassing but very true. I ended up taking much longer. You know, we're in year two. My publisher my editor hasn't seen me. The Lewinsky scandal is gone. We're now already in Bush years. And I realize I don't know how to revise what I've written. I don't know how to make it good. Editors are not as helpful as you'd hope. And so I stopped researching. I stopped writing. And I put myself on a little 6-month self-apprenticeship program. I went to the library. I checked out all the books on how to write thrillers, how to write genre fiction, even how to write a great essay on how to write pornography, actually very helpful. Because I did some something called The Artist's Way, which was a kind of creativity set of exercises, because I finally realized, well, what is my goal here? I'm not trying to get tenure. I'm never going to make much money from writing the history. And I realized, am I trying to teach people? I realized, no. There's only one goal when you're writing a book, at least for me, and that is to get people to turn the page. And so I decided I needed to teach myself suspense. My favorite book by far was a book called Conflict, Action, Suspense. And I did all the exercises. Who's the protagonist? Who's the antagonist? What do they want? What's thwarting them? What's the climax? What is the 5-act structure of the chapter, of the section of the book? And then I went back and rewrote it. But by that time, my editor didn't remember me. The Lewinsky scandal's long past, and she dropped my contract, and I was overdue, so dropped the contract. I mean, it was a big deal, because I had enough money that I was now going to have to pay back. That is where something like that thesis experience really came in handy. Like, okay, no, just got to sit down, buckle down, and resell it. And it turned out to be the best thing in the world. I rewrote it again. I cut it again. It made the book 10,000 times better.
Did you then get a new agent?
No, same agent.
A new publisher.
Yes, new publisher.
And it was published, of course, by Doubleday.
Much better editor for me, much better house for me, everything about it.
Who was your editor there?
A fellow named Jerry Howard. He's the one who sent you the book, actually.
He told me he had a lot of fun With the book,
he was a delight. Yeah. I really, Beecher does much of the work, I have to say. Yeah. Everyone loves him.
Do you want to tell us about your new project, or is that something that's you don't like to talk about because you're in the process of it?
No, I'm not. I should probably err too much on the side of candor, and as most of my friends would tell me, that I know some authors are secretive, but I figure, what's the point? In fact, nothing like Henry to teach you that kind of generosity. Well, you know, I was never going to write another book again. It was so hard at the end, the final push, and I was so nervous. And of course, it's I spent so long on it that every year that I took, I had to be that much better. Yeah. You know, like throwing good money after bad. And so I was very nervous at the end, and I was stressed, and I felt like a 19th century schoolboy. I had ruined my health. My eyes were going. I was sure that I was ruined. But then at a certain point, after about a year and a half, I decided, that was fun. I guess I forgot all the unfun parts. Yeah. So I thought, well, why would I write another book? Why do I read history at all? Right. And I thought, well, the reason I like history, the reason I came to Amherst is I like a time machine. I like the feeling of taking a time machine somewhere. So where would I want to go? And I thought, okay, how about the 1920s? I don't know. It seems like fun. It was really kind of random. The next step in the American studies pantheon.
Sure.
And I'd always loved the 20s. And so I just started reading last January, just reading around. Mm-hmm. And I finally, much like Henry, I think my subject probably chose me. It's very different. As my editor, Jerry, says, it is. I'm going from America's most famous minister to America's most famous madam. But it's a subject that I'm sure some of our listeners will know. Polly Adler is her name. Okay. She was a very, very famous Prohibition era madam here in New York City. She ran a speakeasy brothel that was hosted, she was very close to the Algonquin Round Table, to the Broadway entertainment world, like George S. Kaufman or Milton Berle or Desi Arnaz all frequented her.
How did you encounter her first?
I literally was just going through the stacks, which is why open stacks are so important, and I found her biography. She was also very involved with the Jewish-Italian syndicate that became Murder, Inc. Mm-hmm. So it was I was just looking around for something that was interesting, picked up her autobiography, which she published in 1952, and this is probably why some people will remember it. My father-in-law, class of 54 at Amherst, immediately knew exactly who I was talking about because he had been a junior in high school when that book came out, and she had a huge bestseller with an autobiography called A House Is Not a Home, and it became a movie, not a very good movie, with Shelley Winters in the 60s. And she is like Henry, a kind of Forrest Gump character that I think allows us to sort of say, well, what happened between the end of that Victorian period that really was about gentility, that was about conformity, that was about reverence, that takes us to now? And it's quite clear that the 20s brought in irreverence, it brought in female independence, it brought in a certain topsy-turvy quality, that all the things that we didn't like before as a culture, we now were valorizing.
Would you say then you're writing a kind of cultural biography of Adler?
Well, very much the same as with Henry, I'm hoping shorter in time and not as heavy in final product.
Right. I wanted to ask you also, do you hope to go with the same publisher, or is that sort of a secret? Or?
Well, I haven't sold it yet. I figure, I think the nice thing about having won the Pulitzer Prize is all of a sudden everybody treats you as if you're much fancier than you were. I mean, it's embarrassing.
How did you first hear about that? Did you get a phone call or something?
I got a phone call from my editor, and I will say, and all the people, the first people who called me were all Amherst people, all of whom were in the finance industry, and it was because they were watching it on TV, and it just goes to show all those people making money, really? You're watching TV all the time? But he called, and what's funny is, I tell you, I really do spend a lot of time with Amherst people. My godchild, I think, class of 2021, and the daughter of an Amherst couple. I had been playing with my godchildren, and they had knocked me over, and I had my very first black eye when I had gotten it like 2 days before, and it was just coming in like really vivid and purple when the news came. And immediately, as soon as my editor called, the phone start going off the radar, cell phone, the regular phone, everyone's calling, and the press starts to call immediately, which of course I'd never, like sitting alone like a bookworm for 20 years and all of a sudden having people call and say, we're sending photographers over right now. Wow. And it was this moment where my vanity, of course, had just soared.
Of course.
And all of a sudden realizing as I'm on the phone looking at my black eye and them telling me the photographers are about to arrive, my vanity just pricked and collapsed.
You
get like
out
one moment.
The makeup and the cover up or
it
whatever.
It was no good. Yeah. We did sort of shots like a 1920s movie star, only from the, and they are still terrible, and they are still on the web, and I regret it to this day.
That's funny, yeah.
So in terms of selling the book, I had the option to sell it practically on a handshake, I have to say.
Yeah.
But you know what, I I'm too much conservative. I think I'm too cautious to do that. So.
Right. And how did it change your life in the long run? Obviously, you're now kind of a household name to a lot of people and so forth.
Well, that is not. I don't know whose household you're in, but
well,
that's
anyway.
Not.
I mean, did it affect you professionally, or did it kind of sit there in your mind as something? Obviously, you'd like to win another Pulitzer, but.
Actually, I'd rather have a book that really sells.
Oh, right. Yeah, I know what you mean. Me too. We all would, right?
Yeah.
But how do you feel it has sort of affected you in the long run?
Well, I will say,
I mean, you know,
I very quickly found myself humming this song by the Eagle, Joe Walsh, a song that I really don't particularly like called Life's Been Good to Me So Far. And I really felt like everyone's so different and I'm still the same. And it really was instant that everyone started, I was a striver. I was a lace curtain Irish striver.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden I was being treated like I was somebody different. And that is... startling. It's not terrible, but it does mean all of a sudden, for example, I find I have to actually watch what I say a little bit, especially write. I no longer will be quite as candid when I write things because I just feel like my husband thinks I have become less civilized. Actually, he thinks I'm becoming less careful, like taking advantage. So that's one thing. I mean, that was definitely a big psychological factor. But then the other thing is, the Pulitzer Prize winner Richard Ford, I believe, said the Pulitzer Prize is the gift that keeps on giving, and I will probably go to my grave even if I never wrote another book, getting to have the honor of this office, and it means that in fact opportunities do come my way. It is like having tenure in the world, and now what I do with them is. It sort is up to me, but certain people are nicer.
I should probably know this, but is your husband also an author? Or?
Yeah, he's class of 89, and he writes. He has published, I don't know, like a dozen books to my book. I probably should know how many. Generational change in the workplace, and he writes about managing people. How do you actually get people to do what you want?
He's an economist.
No, he went to law school, and frankly, the reason why he ended up here is he went to law school right out of Amherst, worked for, I believe, 428 days as a New York lawyer, and realized he had to get some other job, and so he started interviewing starting with other Amherst people, just our friends. Well, what do you do for a living? Right. And very quickly had enough material that it became his first book, Managing Generation X. And and I have to say it really helped having – and then he became a consultant and a speaker. But it really helped for a variety of reasons. One thing is, as anyone will tell you, it's not easy to write a long book like this unless you are teaching – freelancing or have some kind of support. Right. And having a spouse made that difference.
Yeah.
But also having an entrepreneur, someone who had done what I had done, left grad. Right. He's the one who encouraged me to mm-hmm. get off the academic track. I didn't have to stay there if I didn't want to. Right. He's the one who made me, once the book was published, send out 200 packets to various institutions and publications. He's the one that keeps mm-hmm. reminding me, oh, I have to write more pieces or do more speaking gigs. Or
he urges
interviews.
You on and supports you and encourages you.
That's right. Yeah, and I
nice.
Bring him, it turns out, prestige,
yeah,
if not
that,
cash.
That's always nice. That's always nice. What's his name again?
Bruce Tolgan.
Bruce Tolgan.
Okay. In fact, I meant to suggest him for the Author Read series. He's got a I should put in a plug. He's got a book coming out in February called okay. "Not Everyone Wins a Trophy," his Gen Y book.
Okay, good. Sounds great. you had mentioned that you were you raised in Portland?
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
That's right.
And do you often go back there to Portland?
I do, and I like the West. I miss the mountains. That's the one thing New England doesn't have, and New York. Doesn't have. I like New York, and I like mountains, and they just don't go together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I grew up in New England, and then I went out west, and then I came back to New York. So, with a little. Stop over in Chicago for 3 years, where I taught at Northwestern. So,
you've done all of it.
I've done all three, and I really love New England. I guess ultimately I like New York quite a lot. I became a California convert when I was out there, but my sister lives in Portland right now, so I sometimes go out there. And
well, I should say one of the funny thing was. When my book came out and it was the prize season and it had been a finalist for a number of things, I went to the National Book Critics Circle Award ceremony, which I didn't win, and that was fine. It was such an honor.
Sure.
It really is. You can't.
Yeah, I was nominated for that too.
Yeah, it's
which
such an
I
honor.
Didn't win either, but it was. You know,
they're just neat. It's a neat occasion. But and there were a number of other New York events, including the Pulitzer Prize event. And what's funny is I remember a non-academic friend going to one of these events with me in New York saying, "Why is everyone dressed like this?" I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, they kind of look shabby, sort of. Yeah, kind of low, downscale.
Yeah.
Is it political? Are they trying to make a statement?" I was like, "Well, no, they're just writers and academics, and that's the way they dress." Until the last of the ceremonies was the LA Times Prize, which I also did not win, but it's okay. I got one, and that was fine. And
you got the big one.
And we got out. I remember Bruce and I got out to this grand event. It makes everything back east, everything in New York, you think the capital of glamour, oh no, it makes it look shabby. There's movie stars around, there's lights, there's fountains of chocolate, ice sculptures, everything you want. And I said, and there were a lot of the same people, because, you know, we'd all kind of been trooping from place to place. And I said, geez, everything looks better. And not only that, even the authors look a lot more glamorous. I said, why is that? And Bruce says, well, maybe it's because, like you, they all decided to lose 5 pounds because they were going to California.
We'd all
be slimmer, even if we didn't work harder.
Yeah, the prize ceremonies are always a lot of fun. What was the Pulitzer Committee prize like? Was that kind of a fancy situation?
Well, it's very somber.
It's a
lunch in the rotunda of Lowe Library in Columbia. And no speeches. They're very clear. They do not want, because you can imagine a whole bunch of gabbers.
People would go on for an hour.
And nobody, but actually, I think deep down we were all relieved.
Yeah.
Because it just, it's stressful.
Much better to say thank you.
Yes. And what's funny is now everyone wants to see the actual prize. And I must say, everyone's a little disappointed. They want some kind of big Oscar. And really, it's just a little tchotchka, but you can hold it in your hand if you want to. You can walk around with it if you feel bad about yourself. In the end, though, I really, I know it's all Amherst boosterism, but I really do want to say, because this is the forum to say it, none of this would have happened without Amherst. Not simply because it gave me Henry, but it just gave me every tool, everything that I had, every bit of confidence, every friend. Amherst people came out in droves to support me and help me during this process. And it really, Well, I mean, in a way, there's nothing to say except there's a reason why Amherst is a place of book lovers. It's because they breed book lovers. They create book lovers.
Right, yeah. Well, I think it taught me just how to read, even though I'm now more of a historian, although I'm an English professor, but just how to read a text. I mean, in a way, I will see history as a kind of a text anyway. So
yeah, right.
But so writing that thesis on John Donne's poetry was actually a very good training just in careful analysis and writing, and so all of that. It's just, and as you say, being surrounded by bookish people was
and
serious
just tell
people.
Yeah. One last little thing. Someone was asking me about David Foster Wallace.
Yep.
And
did you know him?
I did not know him. He was, I think he graduated a year or two before I got there. Remember when his first book came out, and I hadn't read the book, but I saw his name, and this was still that same job in the Amherst College Archives, and one of the things I was doing was taking all the senior theses, out of their acidic binders and putting them in some other less acidic thing for preservation. And I saw his thesis, and I ended up reading it over my lunch hours. It was that I was working there for the summer, and his thesis was, I went on to read his book, The Broom of the System, was the first half of The Broom of the System. This was his double thesis, of course, his second thesis. And I remember not, of course, that I
was... Was there something about it that stood out even
Well, it was super fun to read. It was a fiction. It was a piece of fiction. And it was... It was maybe not word for word exactly, but it was very close to, and it's about Amherst, and so it was fun. But it ended up being a really, I think, important symbol to me. That look, here, I did not plan on turning my senior thesis into my life's work, for Christ's sake. I did not want to spend my youth in a library. Yeah. But I think that I could see it. I could see how someone could do that, and someone so smart, I mean, and so clearly ambitious, that it was very inspiring over time, and it is, of course, all the more reason to be so sad about his loss.
Yes, of course. That was such a shock. I was very moved, of course, by the reports in the New York Times, and then also through Amherst and all of that, the outrushing of acknowledgement of his genius and all of that, but... At any rate, Debbie, thank you so much. It's been great. You deserve the Pulitzer, to be sure.
You're very nice.
Hopefully, you'll get one for your next one. But also, you can't.
I'll go for bestseller, cheap, tawdry bestseller.
You'll take the bestseller list, right? At any rate.
Well, thank you.